In the beginning, there was no wall. Then...
it cuts through the heart of Berlin. We have learned to live with it.
The world learned to live with it for half a century, and then suddenly Europe's dividing line became a pile of souvenir rubble. Some objects are immovable until they simply vanish. Looking for holes in the walls around Cuba, young people try to separate reality from the Cold War relics. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Check your calendars. April 15th, tax day. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is home with her new baby. We've got a great show this morning. Star of stage, screen, print, queen of all media, Lynn Scherer is here. Coming up this hour, you may think you want to help the environment, but your own brain may be thwarting your green intentions. We'll explain some interesting new neuroscience. All this and more, but first, headlines. Somali pirates are still going after American cargo ships. They fired grenades and assault rifles at a freighter carrying aid for Africa. The USS Bainbridge arrived to help and escort the ship to Kenya. The pirate attacks are renewing a debate about arming merchant ships. For now, they improvise a defense, like blasting pirates with fire hoses, but the Bainbridge commander, Frank Castellano, says it's worth thinking about giving shipping crews real weapons.
It's a very similar question that happened after September 11th about arming crew members on airplanes. And I think that's something that probably needs to be discussed.
Critics say arming cargo crews would raise the level of violence and a hijacking and could lead to more deaths. They want to leave gunfighting to the U.S. Navy. I did all the piracy there, Femi. What else is going on?
Yeah, how did you leave me? Okay, well, we're still looking at North Korea.
A huge story.
Yeah, the country is taking another step back from nuclear disarmament. It's kicking out United Nations nuclear inspectors, and this follows Pyongyang's declaration it will pull out of long-running six-country arms talks. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says that building nukes will not help the country's isolation.
North Korea will not find acceptance by the international community unless it verifiably abandons its pursuit of nuclear weapons.
Today, North Korea marks the birthday of its late leader Kim Il-sung. He's technically still the so-called eternal president of the country, even as his son Kim Jong-il rules the country. U.S. Special Envoy George Mitchell is in Israel today. It's his first visit to the region since the new right-leaning government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu took power. Later this week, Mitchell will talk to Palestinians in the West Bank. North Dakota is bracing for another round of flooding. The Cheyenne River is at record highs. It's expected to crest later this week. Public schools are cancelled so students can fill sandbags, and the danger zone is just west of Fargo.
They cannot get a break there on the prairie. We'll get two new reports on retail prices and industrial production later today, just ahead of Wall Street's open. The Dow and S&P bouncing around yesterday. The S&P lost 2%. The Dow dropped nearly 2%. It starts trading at 79.20. So it is tax day, as I mentioned. And whatever you think about taxes, whatever you think about your tax form, somewhere buried in that tax form is how you feel about your government. That's why there's no comments page on your tax form. But if there were, what is the message from you to your government based on, you know, what you did on your taxes, the deduction you took, the income you didn't report? Because you know what? Those AIG guys didn't report, right? How are you feeling about the government? Send us your comments at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. And in for Adora Udoji this morning is Lynn Scherer. We welcome her back to the program. A veteran journalist, former 2020 correspondent for ABC, author, radio, currently working for PBS. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Just keep going. I mean, I'm going to walk you around as my resume. By the way, my taxes are in, just
good.
That I'd point
glad
that out.
To hear it. Glad to hear it. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about the sort of mentality of what it is you think about your government when you do your taxes and why you might be inclined to cheat or not, depending on your mood. What is your mood regarding your government, regarding your taxes? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. But we begin with the Middle East. I know, Lynn, you have a long history of covering this story, as do I. U.S. Envoy George Mitchell arrives today in Israel as part of his two-week regional tour. And this is what he said about his appointment as Middle East envoy back in January 22nd of this year.
I form the conviction that there is no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. Conflicts are created, conducted, and sustained by human beings. They can be ended by human beings.
And George Mitchell is talking to all the human beings involved in the Middle East conflict. He was in North Africa most recently. As I said, he is welcome to Israel today. Rosemary Hollis joins us now. She's an international relations expert focusing on the Middle East and is director of the Olive Tree Program at City University in London. She joins us from London. Rosemary Hollis, it seems as though George Mitchell faces rings of purgatory in attempting to end the Arab-Israeli conflict. Let me just identify three. First, there is the broad Arab coalition as to what to do now, which George Mitchell is attempting to put together. There's the brand new government in Israel, which poses its own challenges, Benjamin Netanyahu. And then there's the question of a single unified front for the Palestinians, which has eluded the Palestinians themselves since Hamas took control of Gaza and Fatah has remained in the West Bank. Rosemary Hollis, let's start with the Palestinians. How challenging is that for George Mitchell?
Well, I think up till now, and probably George Mitchell will do the same thing, up till now, the reliance has been on the Egyptians and the Saudis to try and broker a deal between the Hamas leadership in the Gaza Strip and the Fatah leadership and president, as recognized by the West, and prime minister, as recognized by the West, in the West Bank. But that diplomacy between the factions to see if they can join together to get Gaza rebuilt, to channel the money to rebuild Gaza, and indeed to enter peace negotiations, assuming they're on offer, that has been very difficult, tortuous process, and it's nowhere near complete or
Rosemary,
successful yet.
It would seem as though the opportunity to rebuild Gaza would come with it, you know, all kinds of ways of developing credibility with Hamas, that the quid pro quo involved in the kinds of investment that will be taking place in Gaza might, in some sense, be a bridge to dealing with Hamas politically. But it hasn't worked out that way so far. Why?
Well, there's certainly a lot of voices against any kind of legitimation of Hamas leadership in the Gaza Strip through the back door, i.e. through the disbursement of development and reconstruction aid. The Israelis hitherto have been dead against any kind of dealings with Hamas, although it's conceivable that they would negotiate behind the scenes through intermediaries over specific issues like the return of the captured soldier Gilad Shalit in return for some Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and so on. But they have stuck with the idea that was championed by the Bush administration that Hamas could somehow be forced out of power and be marginalized if nobody dealt with the Hamas leadership. That has proved a false hope over the last 3 years, and now there are voices being raised for a different approach, which would bring them into the picture.
Well, what is the possibility of getting Fatah together with Hamas in the sense that, okay, maybe the Israelis don't want to deal with Hamas, but can Fatah in any sense deal with Hamas? And is there any sort of intermediary, be it Turkey, be it Algeria, that could speak for both, even to get preliminary talks started?
Well, so far, the Egyptians have wanted to take the lead in trying to get both factions together. But it seems that they recently referred the issue to the Saudis for their help. And Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, went to Saudi Arabia seemingly to discuss why he's objecting to an arrangement brokered by the Egyptians for dealing with the Hamas leadership. And Abbas's objection, which is characteristic of the old guard Fatah leadership in general, is that they don't want to share any power with the Hamas leadership. The rivalry between them is so bitter that they are jeopardizing the future of the Palestinian people and the future of any kind of peace negotiations in the name of trying to defeat one another.
Well, which leads us directly to the issue of the Israeli government now, which is sort of this second ring of purgatory I was talking about. You've got Benjamin Netanyahu in a conservative government, the foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, who has called explicitly for a rollback of any discussions of peace with the Palestinians. How much of a challenge is that for someone like George Mitchell?
It's a big challenge if you are absolutely set on achieving progress towards an independent, sovereign Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza alongside Israel. However, it perhaps is worth pointing out that where Netanyahu is coming from, and up to a point Lieberman, is in tune with the mood in Israel pretty much, insofar as they don't feel that now is the time to negotiate a deal because of the weakness and division on the Palestinian side, and also because of the cost to Israel. They argue that were they to negotiate away the West Bank, they could find themselves in the same position as they feel they are with the Gaza Strip today, under attack from Hamas leadership, with southern Lebanon today under attack from Hezbollah militia. And why on earth, they ask, would they be fools enough to give the Palestinians a new jumping off ground to attack them from the Eastern Front as well?
Rosemary Linscher here. What does George Mitchell bring to the table, and to what extent can he make a difference after, of course, what he did famously in Northern Ireland? Will they give him that same kind of respect? Can he make it happen?
He certainly got more traction on the Arab side of the picture and across the region. And it's interesting that he is going to Israel today on the back of a trip which has encompassed North Africa and will in due course encompass other states in the region. He obviously wants to have the support of leading Arab states behind him to give ballast to the weak and fractured Palestinian leadership to overcome the Israeli argument that there's no partner to deal with. And because of his record, and because he was tough on the Israelis previously in 2001 when he issued a report on the situation and said that settlement expansion had to stop if there was to be hope of peace, that has got him supporters on the Arab side of the picture. But it has also made the Israelis wary.
Well, it's also the case that the potential very, very quickly becomes inertia in the Middle East. And just going back to what you said a moment ago, I mean, if the Israelis have no incentive to talk to the Palestinians as long as they're divided, then I don't see what Mitchell's in is here. I don't see what his wedge is. And some have talked at the BBC this morning even that there's a 22-state solution that Mitchell could pursue where you would get a broad Arab coalition to force some sort of a settlement. Could Mitchell take that route?
I think he is intending to take that route and to capitalize on the Arab Initiative, which offers peace with Israel, recognition of Israel in the event that Israel withdraws from the West Bank and enables a Palestinian state to emerge with Jerusalem as its capital alongside Israel using Jerusalem as its capital. But in the way of that kind of deal are the settlers who are all over the West Bank at the moment and in the major blocks along and beside the security barrier that the Israelis have been building over the last few years. And successive Israeli prime ministers have said they can't realistically take on the settler movement. It will split Israeli society unless and until there's such an attractive deal that it's irresistible. Well, that's a chimera. And this is the kind of thing that Mitchell can't overcome. But what will be interesting is to see whether he ends up having a real conversation with the new Israeli leadership about what are the alternatives to a two-state solution. If it's impossible, what do you propose instead?
Well, and the question really is, is there an alternative to the two-state solution, or does this constitute something of a death knell to the two-state solution? And interesting, we'll have to just sort of take that, Rosemary Hollis, as a positive for a conversation on the formidable challenges facing George Mitchell as he arrives in Israel today. Rosemary Hollis, international relations expert focusing on the Middle East and director of the Olive Tree Program at City University in London. Thank you, Rosemary.
Thanks.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.